General Pike, Reel 2.
To attack and capture some feature, general concerned would visit the front line battalions, brigades. He would discuss possible methods with forward troops. He would then come back and make his plan. We would, as we are nearly always short of men and formations and equipment, we would probably try and do it with rather less than was necessary. And so we might well fail for lack of putting in enough. That is a fault the Americans never do. On the other hand, we have consulted those people going to do it, taken their views, and in my view, we make a better plan, though we have fewer resources with which to carry it out.
Did these differences ever cause any mutual irritation?
I think they possibly did. The Americans tended to say that with the British, an order was a basis for discussion, we would naturally disagree with that. We got on very well with the Americans. I think they realized that our methods were different. And all I can say is that people like the Canadians, who knew both sides best, although they loved American equipment, they preferred our methods. Again, we had a rather different technique with our handling of artillery. When the front stabilized, the Americans set up an elaborate system of telephone communications. We also had our telephone communications, but we relied, priority one, on a superb radio network. The Americans used their radio as a second priority. And so when there was a Chinese attack, very often the American communications would be decimated, and they would have not got their radio network as efficiently organized as we did. We did all our operational work, artillery work, on this radio network. There were two frequencies. One was the divisional artillery, and the other were each regiment had its own frequency. And it was so organized that you could flick from one to another so that you could operate either on the regimental frequency or on the divisional frequency. We had the system whereby if an OP officer or forward observing officer requested fire from the front, he was automatically through because he was on the net, the radio net. Everybody would set to and work out the necessary target procedures for what his request was. If down the line it was considered that his request wasn't justified, or if he was asking for too much, then at battery or regimental or divisional headquarter level, you would check it. And so you would either agree it or you would stop it. And this meant that if it was a really good target, the orders would go through and the fire would be down in a matter of a couple of minutes. And you could get the whole of the divisional artillery onto an important target within 2 minutes. The American system, they had fire direction centers which were based at their regimental and battalion regimental and divisional headquarters, and any requests for fire had to go down and be sorted out there. They had to get authority to fire. And that meant, in fact, especially as they were using a telephone system which was very often knocked out, that they were very much slower than we were. And we got a great reputation for our speed of action in getting guns to bear on targets. So much so that it became rather embarrassing, because the corps or divisional commanders would say to their divisional artillery commanders, how is it that the British get their fire down so much quicker than we, than you do? And they would come and pay me visits to see what our technique was. And it was always rather embarrassing when somebody is sent to you and is not too pleased being sent, to find out why you apparently are being rather more successful than they were. It was just our system, because we used to have American battalions attached to us. We had a superb 8-inch battalion and a 155 medium battalion attached to us, and they came on our system, and they were just as quick. Indeed, they were nearly always first to be ready to fire. So they fitted into our system exactly as our own units did, and were just as effective. So it's just that I think we had produced a system of artillery fire which was supreme and was extremely good. And the American Meteor, that is, you used to get regularly, every few hours, the atmospheric details of temperature and wind and so on, and these you would use for adjusting your fire. During operations, they would send it in much more frequently than every hour. You would then adjust your range according to the meteor data you had sent, and you could get your fire down without ranging.
What about differences between the different national divisions within the Commonwealth Division? Did that ever cause any tension?
No, that caused none. It was a little tricky at first, because people who've been independent don't like coming under a new master, and the brigades had all been independent. And the Canadians and the 29th British Brigade didn't like being circumscribed and ordered about by a new divisional headquarters. On the other hand, the 28th Brigade were very pleased, because they had not been so well found as 29th, and so they got a lot of things through the division which they otherwise would not have had. But that initial feeling of wish we were independent soon passed, and we got on supremely well. I can't think of any occasions when cooperation as between us all wasn't absolutely first class.
Now, to come on to your own personal duties, can you tell me what they were and what were your main problems that you had to deal with personally?
Well, my main task was to support the division, particularly, of course, the frontline infantry, support them with artillery fire, whether they were being attacked or whether they were attacking themselves. Artillery is a factor of enormous importance. In defense, if the infantry are attacked, they wish our own artillery naturally to come down and kill as many of the enemy as they can. And in those early days, one would bring down fire on enemy as they approached, and one would bring the fire down to within 100 yards or so of our own men. Latterly, when we had got dug in, we did what the Chinese did. And that was, if we were attacked, having operated them and fired on them as they were in the act of attacking. When they got up on the hill, you would go down below into your bunkers, and the enemy would be swarming about on top, and you would bring your own fire down on your own hill, and you would then kill the enemy and not yourself. This was a very famous Chinese technique. They dug magnificently, right down deep, and if you put an attack in on a Chinese hill, you would be fired at on your way up. As soon as you got there, they would all disappear down deep into their bunkers, and you would be roaming about on the top, probably in the dark, not knowing where you were, in the open, and then the Chinese would open with their mortars and artillery on you. So I think they taught us that, and we eventually did that. So in defense, you are the whole time putting artillery down on the enemy who are in the process of attacking us. In attack, of course, you put down covering fire just ahead of your own soldiers so that you keep down the heads of the enemy who are firing on your own infantry as they advance. And so you give this covering fire, and then of course if they counterattack, you again put your fire down. And then another very important aspect, especially when you get into static warfare, is what is called counter-battery, because one whole time you are harassing the enemy, you are bringing down fire on where you think his front lines are. You try and hit his communication centers. You harass him. You make yourself as big a nuisance as you can with your artillery so that he can never move about comfortably or safely. And naturally, when he does that to you, you try and stop him. And the only way you can stop him is to try and locate his mortars or his guns. And we got set up a very sophisticated counter-bombardment organization, which is a well-known unit. And you have sound ranging and radar and what you'll call shell reps. Whenever anybody is shelled, they report where the shell has landed, and if they hear the gun, the direction it came in. And if people do that, you get a cross section on them. That tells you about where they are, and then you put your radar onto them. Again, the AeroPs used to go up every 2 hours, and they do a standard recce over the area to see if they could see any guns firing, and they would spot and report where they were. So a very important part of the day-to-day battle in static warfare is locating enemy guns and mortars and dealing with them.
Did you have anything at all to do with the South Korean forces?
Yes, we had South Korean division on our flanks on more than one occasion. I got to like and admire them very much. They were, I'm told, not well organized or well equipped or well led in the very early days. Neither, I think, were the Americans. They were simply were not ready. However, the Americans saw to it that they were quickly well equipped, they went into good training, and certainly by the time we were operating, I thought the Korean divisions were very good. They were stout fighters, they were well disciplined, and I think pretty well led. So I have a high regard for the South Korean army. Very tough lot. They live a tough basic life, and they can stand hardship, which would be much greater hardship for you or me.
But you said you never came into contact with the North Korean army.
No. They were out on the eastern flank. The early 27th Brigade, but of course 29th Brigade had a certain contact with them. But by the time the Commonwealth Division was formed, we had the Chinese opposite us and the North Koreans all further out on the east.
Did you ever take prisoners from amongst the Chinese?
Yeah, occasionally. They were very difficult to capture, and we were often told or ordered to capture a prisoner. And it was a very difficult thing to do for the reasons I've just been explaining. If you put in an attack to try and capture a hill feature and get a prisoner, you got up there and there was nobody to be found. They were all down in these deep bunkers, and you were being shot at. You would go down into a bunker and turn a corner and get a burst of fire in your face. And so getting a prisoner was exceedingly difficult. We tried on many occasions. It caused us a good many casualties, and we were not very successful. On one occasion, various other methods were employed. On one occasion, we sent a party out who cut telephone lines between two Korean positions and then waited for the signalers to come out and mend it. And of course, two signalers did come out. Two Koreans did come out to mend the line. And they tried to knock them on the head, but they made such a terrible noise that they ended by shooting both of them. Because otherwise, out in the middle of the Chinese territory, with these two chaps screaming their heads off, the next thing is you'd have been shot yourself. So it was an extremely difficult operation. We did catch some by those sort of methods, but they were very difficult and very expensive in casualties. In mobile warfare, of course, it's much easier. It's in that static warfare where it was so difficult.
Did you see any of the Chinese captives?
Captain?
Did you actually see any of the Chinese prisoners?
I saw a couple come through, yes. I have seen the odd ones, yes. They were. But, I mean, if you capture a prisoner, they're very quickly put through back to the area where they're properly interrogated. So you never keep a prisoner long, and you will get him back as soon as you can.
What kind of condition were they in?
Well, they were much as you might imagine. They were wearing a very dull sort of uniform, rather like you see Chinese peasants in now. They were perfectly good condition. They existed on a handful of food, and I'm told by those who captured them, if you talk Chinese, they were extremely easy to talk to and full of a great sense of humour, so I've been told. But I didn't have any experience of talking to them myself, but they seemed to be what you might say just good, rough, basic soldiers, tolerably well clothed and equipped.
Would they give information, do you know?
I don't know. I think they did, but I don't think they usually knew very much.
Was there much of a propaganda war between the two sides?
I can't remember us shouting at each other. So long ago, I have an idea there was some rival shouting went on, but I can't really remember that. Back of my mind, I seem to remember that occasionally there were slogans and so on shouted.
By which side?
By them. Well, I don't think we did anything on those lines.
What do you remember? What type of things would be shouted?
Oh, sort of political slogans.
Of what kind?
Wicked Americans. I mean, I can't honestly remember. I can't. It was the sort of stupid propaganda which would have no effect on our soldiers. rather a joke, if anything. But I couldn't, I can't be absolutely clear whether I remember that happening or not.
What about leaflets? Leaflets?
No, I don't remember. I don't remember leaflets.
Did you have a large proportion of national servicemen?
Yes, yes, and very good they were. On the whole, the national servicemen were better than the regulars, because the regulars, they had brought in a special 3-year engagement for regulars, which was only a year more than national service, and you used to get men who were not of such high quality becoming regulars in order to get the advantages which a regular had for that doing a regular job for one extra year. The national servicemen just did their 2 years, and they were absolutely first class.
In what way?
Well, they made just jolly good soldiers. Morale was high, and I think they felt they were doing a worthwhile job. My whole experience of national service soldiers was that if you gave them a worthwhile job, they felt they were not wasting their time, and they were first class. On the other hand, if you stuck them somewhere where they just filled in forms or did nothing useful, then I think they used to get very critical and think, not unnaturally, they were just wasting their time. Well, out there, no one could say they were wasting their time. They felt they were doing a really worthwhile job, which indeed they were. Now, I have the greatest admiration for them.
You mean because they were being active rather than passive?
Yes, yes, yes.
Did they ever speak to you about their attitude towards the war itself and why it was being fought?
Not really, no, no. You don't really do that if you're having a war. You're too busy. But I think, by and large, one tried to get across that this was, I think, the first case of an aggression being met head-on. In other words, that it was the first example of an aggressor bringing in not only the hostility of those he attacks, but the hostility of the United Nations. It was their first operation. And I think that did. We certainly tried to bring that across as far as we could, because I felt it myself, that this was the first time the United Nations were trying to put an aggressor in his place. And I think that was a factor.
Had the outbreak of the Korean War taken you by surprise or not?
I suppose it did. I mean, one was thinking about a lot of parts of the world in my part of the War Office then, and I don't remember that Korea ever entered one's knowledge very, very much. I did, but again, it's after all, it's,
35
years ago, and I can't say I can remember, but I should say that I don't think we really were particularly interested in Korea and had no idea that there was going to be an aggression there.
Did the attitude of the British people or British Parliament cause any problems for you?
No, I don't think so, no. I think the British people, one felt, were back of one. I think the British people probably weren't that interested. But certainly there was nothing, no adverse home reactions affecting one. As far as I know, there weren't any. I think we just felt we had full support of those in the UK.
You've given an assessment of the Chinese from the point of view of soldierliness, but apart from that, what was the general attitude of the British forces in Korea towards the the Chinese enemy. Was it one of hatred or respect or what?
I don't think it was one of hatred. It takes a lot to make the British soldier hate. I think they respected the Chinese as a tolerably good foe. I think than anything they preferred them to the Koreans. I think they'd much rather have been captured by the Chinese than the North Koreans. No, I don't think so. Naturally, if you get into a fight and people are killing your best friends and so on, they aren't your best friends. But I think one treated them as one would say the Germans in the war. They were people who thought very differently to us. We thought they were badly led politically. It was just our job to see that they didn't get their way.
Was there any feeling against the Koreans because of the treatment which some British POWs had in the hands of the Japanese in the Second World War?
I don't remember it as such because, of course, I don't think we had anybody who had suffered that treatment. I've always heard that the Korean guards were even tougher than the Japanese guards in the prisoner wars. We had Korean porters who used to come and help carry baggage up, and I think we rather admired them. They were brave and tough and did their stuff and brought the baggage up. One got a sort of, I think, quite a mutual respect going between them. So I don't remember anything of that. I do remember that we had very bad stories of when the end of the war and the prisoners started coming back, then one began to hear of the really bad treatment which our prisoners had at the special...